Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Rest is History. Welcome to the latest live stream. Hello, Tom. How are you?
Hello, Dominic. I'm all right. How are you? Because you've never been better. You've recovered from your COVID, have you?
I have. I've had COVID again. Yeah. I have had COVID, but I'm better.
Like the Queen of Denmark, who's just got it, I see.
So she got it at the funeral. Or must have got it at the funeral or thereabouts. Or maybe she was spreading it at the funeral. Who knows? We will discover in the days to come, won't we? I mean, what if that was a super spreader event, Tom?
I know. Not what she would have wanted. Anyway, welcome, everybody. Wonderful to see people from around the world. So, Davey Oek. Or maybe that's Dave OEC, I don't know, from Ulladulla in New South Wales in Australia.
Yeah, I saw that.
So good, eh? Graham Jackson from Gibraltar and Kate Sullivan from Khartoum. Is that Khartoum as in the Khartoum of General Gordon?
That's not like Khartoum, Missouri or something, Tom.
I don't know. Kate, if you're there, are you speaking from Khartoum in Sudan?
Henry says he's never seen a picture of me before and I look remarkably Tolkien-esque. Like J.R.R. Tolkien or like an orc? Who knows? Or
like tree an bed. Elf. An elvish king. Like Elrond.
Well, I know somebody, C. Brogan Savage says, am I wearing a Versace hoodie? I'm not. I'm wearing actually, it's the Kingdom of Macedon. It's the Kingdom of Macedon. That's what it is. We don't need to discuss my sartorial choices, surely, for too much longer, Tom. But we've got Adele from Cambridge. Hello, Adele. Steve from Williamsburg. Hello. Go on, Tom. Sorry.
You wore a hoodie with the emblem of the Byzantine Empire, didn't you, for when we recorded the episode on Justinian?
It was a T-shirt.
So very appropriate.
They came in the same order, actually, Tom.
Did they?
They did.
Mass ordered Greek theme.
I mass ordered. Yeah, Rest is History episode.
Casual
themes.
Wear.
Casual wear. That very Chinese nice. War with Japan nice. T-shirt has yet to arrive, oddly.
Well, I'm about to go to Corfu, so I should have the opportunity to order some Greek themed casual wear as well.
The Kaiser went to Corfu, didn't he, Tom? Is that right?
I think he did. He went to
Didn't he go to the Achilleion or something like that?
Yes, that had been built by Emperor Sisi, who retired there.
Yeah.
The Princess Diana of the Austro-Hapsburg
Very much Empire. The Habsburg Princess Diana. Yeah.
Yes.
Is that a dead parrot behind you? No, I know what
that
is.
Do you
it's
mean,
your helmet, Tom. It's the helmet.
It's my helmet. I'll bring it over if you want to see it. Hold on.
Yeah. It's very fine, isn't it? You can do the whole thing in that helmet, Tom. You can't hear me because he's taking his headphones off.
So there you go.
I was saying you could do the whole thing. We could have a headgear themed because I've got a Belarusian. I've got a Belarusian communist era officer's cap.
Have you
somewhere in my room? Yeah, it's kind of
thing. You wouldn't want to go to Ukraine wearing that, would you?
I probably wouldn't. No, I wouldn't.
I've talked before about how I got all this kind of reenactor kit. And it was courtesy of my brother, who, when he began the history festival that he stages in the village we grew up in, South Wiltshire, he wanted to bring reenactors to be part of part of the fun. Apparently there is every year a big kind of reenactors costume and props celebration in a huge, and this was in a kind of abandoned air hangar, I think outside Northampton, somewhere like that. And you'd go, and they had costumes and props from every conceivable historical period. So from the Neanderthals right the way up to the Vietnam War. It was brilliant. And the best of all, which I couldn't afford, was a complete outfit from the Les Très Riches Heures du Duc de Berry. So that, 14th century French illuminated manuscripts. It was very, very thingy. What's his name? Bart Van Loo.
Oh, Bart Van Loo.
Yeah, Burgundian. It was Burgundian.
Well, I know we're jumping massively ahead here, Tom, and ruining Dom's outline for the episode. But talking of historically themed clothes, there's a sale in Oxford coming very shortly. Amy Mantravadi and others have advertised this to me. They're selling some of Stanley Baldwin's possessions. So they're selling his dispatch boxes that he had government papers in when he was, I don't think when he was prime minister, I think before that, maybe when he was financial secretary to the Treasury or something. They are selling his court dress that he wore at Buckingham Palace.
Oh, Dominic.
And
you've
bizarrely,
got to have
Tom,
that.
They're also selling as part of the same sort of lot, or the same sale anyway, not the same lot, but the same sale, some of Rudyard Kipling's long socks, because Kipling was his cousin. So somehow they must have come into Baldwin's possession. And
there you go.
Two pairs of black stockings, once the property of Rudyard Kipling, with his name tag sewn on. Estimate £80 to £120.
How adorable that Kipling had name tags on his stockings.
Well, maybe, well, you know, once a boarding school boy, always a boarding school boy, I suppose.
But no Stanley Baldwin stockings.
No, but they've got Baldwin's, they've got other stuff, they've got clothing of Baldwin's.
You've got to get his court dress.
It'd be absurd. It'd be
You've cut a tremendous.
It would be an absolutely indefensible purchase.
Some of his tweed suits.
Well, a tweed suit would be a different matter, because I think Stanley Baldwin
and you could just kind
probably
of
be about the same build. So
I wasn't going to say that, but you could kind of lean over a fence and tap your pipe meditatively.
It's basically the same.
Listen
suit
to the Bilbo tinkling Baggins from the blacksmith.
Right, the Bilbo Baggins would have worn if Bilbo Baggins wore suits. So, Tom, we were going through the whole list of people. We had a great plan about how we were going to move.
Yeah, we did.
Seamlessly.
So I was going to give a shout out to Fiona Baird, who is in the Western Isles in Scotland.
Yeah.
Simply, not just to say hello to Fiona, though. Hello, Fiona. But also because I've just come back from Scotland today. But I've only just been in Scotland because I've just been across the border from the little bit of England that is north of the River Tweed by the estuary. Which is Berwick-on-Tweed, which is English because Richard of Gloucester, the future Richard III, conquered it. And it had been kind of going back and forwards between the England and Scotland. And Richard of Gloucester was the one who finally grabbed it for England.
So
from the English perspective, not all bad. Yes, that's the last time. And then in the Elizabethan period, there was a vast capital outlay from the government in absolutely securing it. So they brought in cutting edge
and stuff, hasn't it?
Brilliant walls. Cutting edge Italian architects to design all these kind of battlements, which of course in the long run turned out to be unnecessary because then James VI became James I of Scotland, the Union of the Crowns, and then the Union of England and Scotland. And so Berwick upon Tweed, although it's part of England, is of course now part of the United Kingdom of Great Britain. However, there is this wholly bogus rumour that it was excluded from the peace treaty that was signed between Britain and Russia after the Crimean War, because it got specified as being neither England nor Scotland. But this is not true. And obviously, so we stand in the wake of Putin-esque saber-rattling this morning, and he's threatened to nuke London. So
who do
I
those
was thinking,
Russian TV programs?
Yes,
they should be issuing their threats at Berwick rather than
quite.
Well, they claim they're going to blow the whole of the United Kingdom up, don't they? So
well, I think they specified London, haven't they?
Have they?
They specified Berlin and London are their two targets.
We did a podcast, didn't we, with Taylor Downing about nuclear war, and I stick to my view that it's best to be killed straight away.
Yes, so that's why we've come rushing down. but have you been to Berwick?
I have. I was in Berwick on the night of the Scottish referendum, Tom.
Were you?
By complete coincidence, because we were doing some filming and we were halfway down. And actually, I remember it. The reason it sticks in my head is because the guy who owned the sort of the restaurant where we went for dinner, me and this sort of TV crew, so there's about four of us, he, you know, it really sort of brought it home that it was more than an arcane constitutional issue, because he said he was terrified about it because he lived in one country and the restaurant was in the other, you know, whatever the.
Yeah.
And he just sort of said, this will be a nightmare for me. It'll be a nightmare for my business. I can't believe this is happening, you know, all this kind of thing. So he got the result he wanted anyway, even if, you know, your friends Tom in the Scottish National Party that they are very close to. Didn't. But yeah, well, it was, that part of the country, you know, normally we don't talk about our weekends, but that part of the country is absolutely steeped in history. Now, I know you had your row with Dan Snow about where visitors...
Yeah, but that was just for show.
It was concocted for the media, wasn't it?
No, it wasn't concocted. I got ambushed by the Times walking off a cricket match.
But Northumbria, that part of Northumbria, is surely as... I mean, if Dan Jack... You met up with Dan Jackson, didn't you?
Yeah.
If Dan Jackson
yesterday
was on this podcast...
Yeah, so Dan came yesterday.
He would, you know, the author of the definitive history of the Northumbrians.
Yeah.
From the Anglo Saxons to the present, he would say that it is more history. There are more layers of history in the Northeast, more palpable layers of history than anywhere else in Britain, wouldn't he? And I don't think
so the first day we were there, we went for a walk along this beautiful beach with a view towards Bamburgh Castle. It looked like a kind of Turner painting. There was great the combination of mist and spray from the waves, and Bamburgh Castle. It's a huge construction kind of looming up in the distance, and then behind us was Holy Island, and then on our left is, we walked towards Bamburgh, so out in the sea was the Farne Islands where St Cuthbert, friend of the show, lived at his last months and died, so the sense of history was all around us. And then we bought some oysters, from Lindisfarne oysters, which apparently date back to 1321. Not the oysters, obviously, but the purveyors of the oysters. So that was good. And then the following day we went to Alnwick, which I think is possibly the most feudal place I've ever been to. You been to Alnwick? So it's the seat of the
person. I have been. They've got a most superb bookshop, haven't they?
That's right. With a kind of little toy train that rushes around, and you take books in and they give you credit, then you can buy loads back. And that was like being in Dan Jackson's brain. Because not only was there the toy train, but there were also piles and collector's books about Thomas Buick and books about, you know, Victorian books on industrial architecture in Newcastle and all kinds of stuff. It's a fabulous place. But that, Dominic, the experience of going to Alnwick, so this great completely ersatz castle.
They filmed Harry Potter at Alnwick, Tom.
Yeah, but it's totally bogus. So the medieval castle got pulled down in the wake of the gunpowder plot. So you remember the Earl of Northumberland got involved in that. And basically they got exiled down to London and told they couldn't go back there. And then that line went extinct. A new family moved in. Brilliant. The second Duke of Northumberland remitted rents for his tenants in the aftermath of the Battle of Waterloo during the agricultural recession, and they built a monument out of gratitude to him.
Aww.
So it's got this lion with a completely erect tail pointing in the direction of the castle.
I wondered where this was going to go.
The story is that when the Duke saw that they could afford to build him this monument, he put their rents back up. Although sadly, this story isn't actually true. It's another apocryphal story.
Ludicrously suicidal. That would be suicidally counterproductive behaviour from the Duke.
But the reason I mentioned that is that it was very, very, there was a very, very royalist vibe. So every single, we went, I think, on the Sunday, and so everything was going to be shut. There was this kind of brewing sense of the funeral, commemoration of Her Majesty, all that kind of stuff. And so that's when I messaged you and everybody else at Goldhanger and said, I think we should postpone putting the episode. We should postpone. First of all, we were going to put out Lady Jane Grey. We should postpone Lady Jane Grey. And secondly, we should, whatever it is we're putting out, we should put it out on Tuesday.
But Tom, I think that's not so much the Northeast. I think that's just England outside London, isn't it? I mean, you just don't get out of London enough.
Well, London was pretty royalist, wasn't it? I mean, that's where the queue was.
I suppose so, yeah.
David Beckham.
That's right, David Beckham. When we did say we weren't going to talk
about the
funeral
on
this.
I
was going to say just about the Northeast. Is the Northeast's feeling of... I mean, you do feel steeped in history there, don't you?
You really do.
Yeah, walking along that beach at Bamber, you've got the kind of, I am Uhtred, son of Uhtred.
Well, because the castles, you know.
Yeah, it's the castles.
So Berwick Railway Station was the site of the Great Hall of the castle which is where Edward the First, you know, sat in judgment and ruled that Robert Bruce shouldn't be king and that John Balliol should. And it's platform two. It's where you get, you know, it's where you get the train to Edinburgh. It's so
But it's
brilliant.
Also, is it not that it's a part of the world that is very, it feels pretty distant from kind of metropolitan modernity. I mean, there's Newcastle, of course, but even Newcastle feels like a long way, I would say. I mean, Dan Jackson would say Newcastle's not a long way from anywhere. I mean, everywhere else just happens to be a long way from Newcastle. But I think there is a sort of sense that you are at the edge of England, that
well you know, it's, so the Prince Bishop of Durham, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, essentially he had kind of responsibility for large swathes of the border between England and Scotland, and the Percys were essentially, I mean, law unto themselves. That's why they were such a threat to the English monarchy. And on the Scottish side, likewise, you have all these, you know, incredible. You've got Melrose. You've got, I mean, it's wonderful. So yeah, I mean, if you have any interest in history, that stretch is brilliant.
Yes,
and then of course, agreed. Lower down you've got Hadrian's Wall. Further north you've got the Antonine Wall. That sense of it being a frontier zone. I mean, it runs right from the Firth of Forth right the way down to the Tyne, really. So yeah, very exciting. Anyway, we shouldn't talk about my holiday.
Okay.
Do we have something else to talk about? Well, what have we got here? We've got...
Let's talk about... So we start with Portugal. Do you want to start with Portugal?
Yeah, let's talk about Portugal. Yeah.
So there was a big... We did the four Portuguese episodes. The final, they were meant to be... They were meant to be one episode, but they became four because... Tom, you rang me up and you literally said, Dominic, you've gone mad. They were your words.
Yeah,
After I said...
I cannot tell a lie.
For four episodes. So we did the four episodes. And unfortunately, I think what happened was that the last one was completely overshadowed, wasn't it, by the sad news about the Queen. So there wasn't as much back and forth about that as we might usually expect.
Didn't we talk about this in Salazar in the last members episode?
I think we touched on it a little bit, but there was a whole interesting discussion. So we had another comment, which you hadn't touched on before, from John Stepek, who said Salazar saved countless lives by ensuring Portugal's neutrality in World War II and helping persuade Franco to do the same. But he also sent numerous young men to their deaths in pointless colonial wars, which is absolutely true, actually. The colonial wars. We will come to this because we're going to do a final episode on the Carnation Revolution of 1974. And the colonial wars play a huge part in that. But then there was a little bit of a discussion on the Discord about authoritarian leaders, how you judge authoritarian leaders, and the various sort of historical parallels with Salazar and so on and so forth. And I think it is an interesting question, Tom, because obviously when you look at somebody like Antonio Salazar or Juan Perón, maybe, or any number of kind of Latin American dictators or sort of developing world Bonapartist dictators, the instinct is to say bad people because they're not democratic, because they're dictatorial and so on and so forth. And it's not that I don't think that's a reasonable response. But obviously, most leaders you talk about in history were not democratically elected. And what do you do with them? I mean, what we've talked with, one issue we've skirted around so much on this podcast is arguably the most influential political leader in world history, Augustus. I mean, Augustus, would he be more repressive than Salazar? I don't know. I mean, not dissimilar, surely.
It's interesting. So I've been reading about Diocletian we've talked about these vast series we're going to be doing on countries that are playing in the Football World Cup in November and December. And Diocletian came from what is now Croatia. So he will be the theme of an episode. The kind of faint echoes of Salazar with him in that he comes to power against a backdrop of endless coups, collapse, the whole fabric of the empire seems to be on the point of disintegration, and he claws back a kind of a form of stability, but it's quite a brutal form of stability. It's dependent on the illusion of republican government that Augustus had spun is completely wiped out. It's nakedly autocratic. It's fiscally very, very oppressive. And of course, Diocletian is a hidebound conservative, And the expression of that is the notorious persecution that he launches against the Christians. So would you rather live in a world where the Roman Empire implodes completely and, you know, presumably there would, the anarchy would be fairly unpleasant to live with, or would you rather live through a world in which Diocletian does what he does and you're endlessly being harassed by tax collectors, or if you're a Christian, kind of having your forms, you know, your right to worship as you want, trampled down? And I think that the question of whether you would rather endure anarchy or order, or to reframe it, utter liberty or oppression, is a fairly timeless one.
Don't you think that
I would rather not have to answer?
Historians tend to reward statism, don't you think?
Yes, I think so.
That because historians tend to say a good ruler is one who has loads of tax, as long as there aren't enough too many chroniclers complaining about excess, you know, King John style complaining about kind of excessive taxes. I mean, I knew as soon as I mentioned 20th century authoritarians, I knew that one of our members, where has he gone? Lee Kuan Yew Respecter would be straight on the case with Singapore, South Korea, and so on and so forth. I mean, this is the issue, isn't it? Our dictators always, and this may be a subject for an entire episode, enlightened, because of course, enlightened despots. What do you say about enlightened despots? Indeed, you know, Napoleon. I mean, they're ambiguous figures, and I think that's what makes them interesting.
Well, I think also that we in the Christian or post-Christian West, and you know where I'll be going with this, have a notion of progress, a sense of teleology, a sense that time's arrow is moving to, you know, the arc of history is moving in a certain direction. And certainly since the end of the Cold War, the assumption has been that it's moving in a democratic, liberal, secular direction. And obviously people don't necessarily like to think that that might not be right.
No, and of course we live in an age of strongmen though right now, don't we? Putin, Erdogan, you know, mine's gone black, but Xi Jinping and so on. So maybe then, who knows? If you look at opinion polls about young people and their views about democracy, they're less attached to the idea of democracy than they would have been 30 or 40 years ago, aren't they? So, I'm just reading.
Yeah, but does that mean
absolutely hilarious comments? Brogan Savage, what do you say about enlightened despots? Great opener on a first date.
Yeah, well, it is if it's Catherine the Great, I suppose. If you're the horse.
Just to answer a couple of other comments that I saw fizzing past. Simon Teakle said he wanted to know about the history of port. We actually did an episode on this, Tom, didn't we? It was one of the 12 days of Christmas.
Yes, we did.
So we talked about the Methuen Treaty, which is a key moment in the evolution of the port wine industry and the foundation of all these sort of the British port houses that you see. They're across the river from Porto, so they're in Vila Nova de Gaia. And that is my answer to the person who said they wanted a little bit of Portuguese. They wanted to hear excellent Portuguese accent. So
well done.
So I saw the opportunity to kill two birds with one stone there, Tom.
good. Well, I think that's, we've sorted out Salazar and the the nature of despotism there. So that's very good. Loch Ness Monster. We talked about that again, didn't we, in the last episode? But on the Pop Cult did point out that we missed the great Loch Ness Monster fact. Sorry, Loch Ness Monster fact.
Yeah, Tom, you don't
Peter know. Scott's it's Latin name for the monster, Nessitarus rhombopteryx, is an anagram of monster hoax by Sir Peter S. Although, as I remember, Sir Peter Scott replied that you could put it into some other thing.
Oh, really?
Yes.
But he really believed in the Loch Ness Monster, didn't he?
Yes, I think so.
Peter Scott? I think the Loch Ness Monster, you were very passionate about that, Tom, and I thought that was a fascinating episode, because it's not really an episode about the monster, is it? It's an episode about the 1930s.
Very good.
You know, he loves this joke so much. I know who this is. He loves this joke so much that he WhatsApped it to me this morning while ranting about Nicholas Witchell. So don't think I don't know who you are.
Deep waters. Not just in Loch Ness.
Shamrock's Plesiosaur Island. That's very good.
Yeah, that is very good.
Admit, that's very good.
Yes. Well, I it's such a, it is an interesting topic. Rather like the like Marilyn Monroe, who we've just done an episode on this week, haven't we?
We have.
I think that's a kind of light, fluffy subject, but again, actually, not really in a way.
No, it's a sort of. I thought Marilyn Monroe was interesting because it was a window. I'd be interested to know what people make of it because I think it's a window into talking about the vanished world, really, of sort of 50s, 60s America. I guess the world that was. That we wouldn't have thought of as a vanished world when we were growing up, would we? Because it was still kind of present. You know, films were on TV. The
well, I remember a Marilyn Monroe season. That's when I must have been about 11, 12 perhaps. So I watched them all then.
But as with so many of these kind of pop cultural questions, you wonder, I mean, I don't know the age profile of our members, but you wonder what does it mean to people who are currently 16, you know, Marilyn Monroe. Do your daughters like Marilyn Monroe, Tom?
No, I don't think so.
Does she register at all? I mean, I often think that about music. That's do people think of Elvis? Do youngsters think of Elvis?
Although, having said that,
weird relic.
Having said that, we both read and enjoyed Sarah Churchwell's book on Marilyn. Churchwell did the episode on
Gone with the Wind.
And she gave a signed copy of that book to Eliza, my younger daughter. So she had read that book.
Really?
So, yeah. So she was interested in, she is quite interested in Marilyn. So I take it back.
Henry Coates is giving absolutely top analysis here. She was super hot. Yes, hotness remains eternal.
Well, that's an interesting question. Does hotness remain eternal? I think actually that standards of beauty and hotness... Mm-hmm.
Arthur Marwick, former antagonist of mine, Tom, Arthur Marwick, the great historian of the 60s, the first historian ever to write about the 60s, he wrote a book.
Was he an adversary of yours?
He was, yeah. Not in any meaningful way. I think he was just the previous person who had written about the 60s. Okay. So I was kind of mean about his work in my...
Okay. Was he mean about you?
No, he was too...
Oh, did he Olympian contempt? He ignored you.
No, I don't think it's so much Olympian contempt, but he had become... How should I put this? He's been dead for 20 years, so... But he'd become an enormous connoisseur of the pleasures of the bottle by that point, Tom. So I'm not sure
That's very 60s behavior.
Yeah, it was very 60s behavior. Anyway, he wrote a book called, I think, called On Beauty or something like that, or Of Beauty or whatever, A History of Beauty. And he argued that it had actually been constant. He said he thought it was a misconception. You know, it was a sort of cliche and an urban myth that people used to prize kind of fleshiness. He said that's never really.
But Marilyn, so Elizabeth Hurley notoriously said, I would hate to be as fat as Marilyn.
Yeah.
I'd kill myself if I was fat as Marilyn, which seems a bit harsh. But I think it's when you look at pictures of, you know, she was a famous beauty and she doesn't look beautiful at all. You know, it's got weird wig. No, oh, I'm thinking about, you know, people in the 18th century or someone in the 19th century.
They really are famous beauties. I think they are just aristocratic rich women who are prized.
No, but often it's kind of famous courtesans. And you look at them and...
Like Skittles, the Duke of Cambridge's... that's right, isn't it? Wasn't it Skittles who hang around with the Duke? Was it the Duke of Cambridge?
Yes.
The world's worst commander?
Her very tight black riding habit.
That's right, yeah.
So and likewise in Roman sculpture, there are... It's often very hard to be certain who, say, these women are.
Right.
But people will say, this must be so-and-so because she was a famous beauty. But she doesn't look beautiful at all. So I merely throw that out.
But I don't know, because I think I tell you what there is in among political biographers. I find it amusing in a very mean-spirited way. because people will never say if somebody's, because the biographers are usually of men, because obviously most men historically, well, most politicians were men, and they will mention the meeting with the sort of society woman, the debutante or whatever, who becomes the politician's wife. And it will always say, unswervingly, it'll say, well, not conventionally attractive, she was a very handsome woman, or something like this. Yeah. They'll never just say they were both bloody ugly. No biographer ever has the courage to say that. So, you know, we told that story in the Love Island, or I told that story in the Love Island episode about Stanley Baldwin and the lovely kind of pining for Lucy when she was playing her cricket and stopping at every station and stuff. Jane, but then when you Google Stanley and Lucy Baldwin, any sense of romance just absolutely ebbs away. I mean, maybe I'm being too harsh.
I think you probably are. I'm sure.
Do you think I'm being too harsh, Tom?
Well, I don't
know. I'm just a very bad person.
Have you seen a photograph of her in her cricket wise? I imagine she would look lovely in those.
Yeah, maybe you're right.
And people really aged faster, didn't they? So that's the other thing, I guess, one has to bear in mind.
Yeah, of course.
You know, so all those kind of photos of you know, men in the trenches or something.
I was just about to say them.
And they all look like...
The camera goes on and on, you're like, how old are those? Those blokes are their
80s. Kind of 19. Yeah. They all look kind of 47.
Exactly, it's true. Teethless men. I know. Absolutely. Sorry, this is not, as somebody said, it's not very woke. Top woke chat this evening, says Jonathan Lawrence. I think this is, you definitely wouldn't get this sort of talk on You're Dead to Me. Would you, Tom?
I think you might. Well, no, probably not. Let's move on. So, Germans Behaving Badly, which is a woke title, isn't it? For the emergence of German idealistic philosophy.
Yes. So,
we really Andrea Wolf
is, let's be honest, Andrea Wolf is your friend.
Yes.
And you said very to proud. Us, I've made a terrible mistake. I promised.
I did not.
Andrea Wolf.
I didn't frame it like that, Dominic. I want that.
You
put
were
on
met
the
with a chorus of abuse from your co-presenter and the production staff, who said,
"I said,
what German romanticism? Are you mad?" And so on. It turned out to be, I'll be the first to admit it. It turned out to be an absolutely fascinating and brilliant episode.
Thank you, Dominic. I knew, when Andrea said, "I'm writing this book about a bunch of German philosophers and poets in the university town of Jena in the 1790s.
Yeah.
And it's Schlegel and Schelling and everybody. And I said, you're mad.
All called Schlegel, yeah.
No one is going to, why would anyone want to read that? And she said, no, it's brilliant. And it was brilliant. But because I knew that had been my reaction, I was nervous of what your reaction would be. And
I'm normally very accommodating to your suggestions. That's an absolute lie.
I knew that you would not, well, because you're John Bullfinger and you go around kicking stones, proving that they exist and all that kind of stuff. So I thought you wouldn't be 100% enthusiastic about it.
No, but she was
I
great.
Persuaded
she
you was and she was fantastic.
You've actually, I said to you the other day, when off camera, as it were, I said, you are on a hot streak with your female guests at the moment, because you've had a really great run of inviting people who I have groaned and moaned about and shaken my head and just been a real misery gut, and then they've turned out to be excellent. So
because we have another one coming up, don't we, next week, Hilary Davidson.
Oh yeah, Jane Austen's Fashma Jane Austen. Yeah,
which I thought was fantastic as well.
Or as I'd call that episode, The Invention of Trousers.
Well, I would very much like to call it Jane Austen and The Invention of Trousers. So I hope that's a good title, isn't it? You'd back me up on that.
Oh, The Wrong Trousers. Call it The Wrong Trousers. That's what I think we should call it.
The Invention of Trousers. Brilliant episode.
That's fascinating. It's so interesting.
Loch Ness Monster it's not just about, you know, the Loch Ness Monster isn't just about plesiosaurs. It's about the broader context. And fashion in the age of Jane Austen isn't just about Empire Line dresses. It's about so much more.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It is genuinely interesting. Not least because her argument is that's basically when maybe not my excellent Macedonian hoodie, but the clothes that we regard as fashionable now, the template was laid down in the Regency, she argues, basically, especially for men, doesn't she?
Yeah, the pattern, so the suit, I mean, this is basically when the suit comes in. And also that it's the first kind of explosive rush of fashion that previously fashion had changed at a much more glacial pace, but because of the combination of media, industry, growing wealth, suddenly the infrastructure is there for fashion as an end in itself. Really, really interesting. And she was a wonderful guest as well. So
she was a good guest. I'll tell you another good guest who came up, who we've forgotten about, Tom, because we did it some time ago. Muriel Zaga, talking about French films. So history of France in 10 films. So we basically gave her the challenge of picking 10 films that explain French history from start to finish. Although, I mean, there's not much about kind of Clovis or the Merovingians. She skips kind of the Merovingians and stuff, doesn't she?
No, she didn't include Asterix, did she? And I called her out on that.
Yeah. Yeah, you behave very ungallantly, I thought. But, that was great. And actually, that's a brilliant episode because that's the kind of episode. I mean, I know we're talking up our own episodes, which is very bad form. But I bet you when you listen to that episode, you will really want to go and see, you know, 5 or 6 of those films because she makes them. She does a brilliant job of selling them and explaining why they're so interesting and all that stuff. Right.
And I particularly recommend the film that has Terry Thomas in it.
Yeah, that was very funny.
Very improbable.
So just on the Andrea Wolfe, Tom, before we move on.
Yes.
Greco rightly comments that we talked for, and lots of people timed us on this, 5 minutes and 10 seconds before she came. We let her get a word in edgeways. That's partly because the topic is really interesting there. So the topic about the subject of individualism, I know it was bad behavior, but the topic of individualism and narcissism, whether we live.
We were being individualistic and narcissistic, weren't we?
We were. But Tom,
we were behaving like a pair of.
But I was thinking about this. Don't you have some. Wouldn't you have a slight quibble with her thesis? Because she basically sees the 1790s as a break, doesn't she? Between an older collective period and then one which is much more individualistic and the sort of worship of the self. But that slightly runs counter to your thesis that the big break in our understanding of ourselves and the world is, you know, I don't know, the first century AD or whatever.
Yeah, well, I wasn't really into that.
But do you think?
I think I very briefly touched on it, that I think that there is something very distinctively Protestant about it. I mean, it's the idea of your soul being touched, you know, your individual communion, the premium that is put on your personal response to God that you have with Protestantism and Luther. And it's essentially a secularized version of that. And that's why it's so interesting that so many of them actually end up becoming Catholic. It's almost like they push it to such extremes that they can't cope with where this, you know, the stresses of this individualism lead them to. And so they retreat to the bosom of Mother Church.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because I think that what the Reformation does, is
in a way, in
the Middle Ages, the individual obviously is important. You do have to, you know, you make your confession. You have to tot up your sins and repent for them before death and so on. And the destination of your individual soul is obviously very important. But I think there is a sense in which, rather like the mass of medically ill-educated people during the pandemic, we were by and large, and I know there were always exceptions to this, but by and large, we were content to do what the medical specialists told us because we didn't know. We assumed that they had our best interests in heart, that they knew what they were talking about. And I think to a degree, that's kind of an analogy for people's relationship to the church in the Middle Ages, that by and large, they were content to accept that people who were specialists
more learned in the understanding men than of God, me know about.
Yes, yeah. That they would know. And it's the Reformation that changes that. But that becomes a source of great pressure and stress, I think, for people. The sense that you are personally and individually responsible for your relationship with God. And I think that is part of what it results in Protestantism leading to skepticism. That it's almost like the stress of it, the pressure of it is too great. And you'd rather have unbelief than the stress of continuing to believe. And that in a sense, I think that German idealism grows out of that. I think it is a manifestation of that. And that in turn is why Catholicism becomes a kind of refuge for so many of those philosophers and poets.
Richard Hindley agrees with you, Tom.
Well, Richard Hindley is very, very wise.
But I mean, that's sort of slightly, isn't that what lots of kind of sociological people have been arguing since the dawn of the 20th century, that Protestantism tends to promote, you know, on the one hand, individualism and self-improvement and all those kinds of things, but on the other, a kind of anomy and an alienation, particularly if it doesn't work out. You feel alone in the world with the kind of judgment of God, without the kind of intermediary, you know, not just the well, the institutions, not just the church, but the family and all those kinds of things, which in Protestant societies tend to be a little bit more fragmented, don't they? I mean, do you not think?
Well, I mean, no. The family is obviously traditionally been very important to traditional Protestantism, but I think that the sense that you have to forge your own relationship with God, that you are responsible yourself for your relationship with God, can become a source of great pressure. And I think looking at the way that deism and indeed atheism emerges over the course of the 17th and 18th century, it seems to emerge more strongly and more coherently from Protestant traditions than from Catholic traditions, I would say.
Yeah.
Okay. So Spinoza would be, who of course is Jewish, but basically when he gets expelled from the synagogue, effectively he has to become a kind of Protestant because there's nothing else for him to be. But right. Already the form of Protestant that he becomes is one that is verging into what we could recognize as a kind of pantheistic atheism, if that's not too much of an oxymoron. Anyway, we're slowly off. This is what comes.
There's a massive chat going on among the enthusiasts for this kind of business on the
All right. Well, let's
on the chat. So I can see that you are clearly going to have to do like multiple episodes about this. So, something else that people are very interested in, which astounds me, but I'm, you know, easily astounded. There's a lot of enthusiasm, it seems, for episodes about the history of Canada. Have you seen this? Or are you too busy talking about Protestantism?
I'm not astounded by that at all.
Layla Bolton, Roland Miners, Fiona Gilsonen, all very excited about the thought. Then that was sort of derailed by the talk of Protestantism. But Ottawa Gal, not surprisingly. So, no, Tom, doing Canada, are you not?
I am.
World Cup series.
Yes,
I am. Have you decided what you're doing?
No, I haven't. But I've kind of got an idea. Now, what's his name? The guy who did the Black Death?
Belich. He hasn't done it. We never recorded with him.
No, but we will. So he's lined up. But he previously wrote a brilliant book about the expansion of the Anglosphere, English-speaking world. So pairing expansion across the United States with what becomes the British Commonwealth. So Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa. And he's brilliant on Canada. So I will probably...
Okay. Try to line him up.
I might rip him off.
And here's an image of top Canadian... I thought, do you know what? I'm always so down on Justin Trudeau, but I thought this...
He had a very good funeral, didn't you think?
I thought he did have a good funeral. I thought it's interesting how the people who normally I would kind of moan and groan about them being too smooth, which is him and your mate Macron, Blairites.
A superb royal funeral, don't you think? Prince Charles, I'm sorry, King, the King.
The King.
Prince Charles, the King.
God almighty.
His first the first trip abroad he's making is to France.
It's to France. Maybe, is he going to reclaim it?
Well, we live in hope.
I mean, we live in hope. Macron did it because it's that classic thing that we talked about on our French president's podcast. Macron I don't think it's just true of French presidents. I always think it's true of politicians generally. I always am struck by Charles Moore talking about this in his biographies of Margaret Thatcher, when he sort of says, you don't get her right if you don't understand the extent to which she enjoyed being an actress. She loved playing the part, walking into the room and being Margaret Thatcher. Macron loves playing the president of France.
Yeah.
And these kinds of opportunities,
he
absolutely, and it's interesting contrasting him with Liz Truss. I shouldn't laugh about our prime minister, but you know, she's terrible at it. Let's be frank.
But you can't imagine Liz, you can't imagine Liz Truss giving anyone a horse, can you? Which is what Macron did.
No, I suppose
the Queen.
Can't. Not something that's ever, you know, it's not a thought experiment I've ever indulged. But no, but she's not good at playing. I mean, she obviously can't speak, which is part of, which is quite a big difficulty. But she's not, she wasn't good at playing that part. So they had the accession council. I don't know if you watched that. Did you watch that?
I
missed
that.
Too much of it.
I think I was at the
club. So when Tony was there, Gordon Brown and Boris and everybody.
And David Cameron in his blue suit.
Cameron in a blue suit, in the wrong suit.
Well, or was it?
But Penny, so Penny Mordaunt, who presided over it as Lord President of the Council, absolutely, you know, lived and breathed the role and kind of loved, clearly loved doing it, being the boss of the occasion. Liz Truss has always seemed like somebody who shrinks, a bit like Theresa May did, shrinks from the occasion. And Macron inhabits it with kind of regal effortlessness, doesn't he?
But
I mean, like
also,
when he went on that incognito walk in London with his dark glasses.
Yes, well, it's like Henry V on the evening of Agincourt. But isn't it also, I mean, it's a field cloth of gold. It's he is the closest to a king of France. And so he is paying his respects to the queen.
He would love to go wrestling with Henry VIII, wouldn't he? And like Francois the First. Macron would
that,
be all
that
about
that. It's that whole
that.
Thing of the long tradition of royal relations, cross-channel relations.
Yeah.
And he played it as General de Gaulle did as well, very well.
Absolutely.
And Mitterrand.
Yes. But obviously Hollande didn't play that part at all.
No.
And that's one reason why the French booted it, got rid of him. He didn't even run again. Sorry, that was a complete red herring. That was a
massive
sidetrack from the talk
about
Canada.
But that's what this is all about. We also had, Jeanette Kok suggested that we get Amstel to sponsor 4 episodes on the Netherlands.
You've been promised those episodes on the Netherlands for a long time, Tom.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got one coming with the World Cup.
Yes.
Are you still sticking with your plan for that? That the producers clearly think is a terrible idea.
No, I'm weighing it up.
I won't tell the people what it is. anyway,
Dutch golden age.
As Benji Lee says, it'll be just call it Holland on Holland. And
well, no, it'll be on the Dutch Republic.
Yeah. Let us. So just to give you an update on where we are before we move on to China and the Second World War, just because we mentioned the World Cup. How many have we recorded now, Tom? Have we recorded about 8
10,
of those?
10, I think.
So we previously, when we mentioned this, there was talk of us doing releasing 2 episodes a day during the World Cup. I don't think that's now going to happen because it will astound people to hear that the episodes are too long.
Should we say the ones we've recorded?
Well, me and my favourites, obviously Dr. Valverde.
No, that'll mean nothing to anyone. So that's the Civil War in Costa Rica.
The Costa Rican Civil War is a very amusing episode.
I think a laughing fit to compare with the Kiblai's wedding, Attis's wedding, and the Dwarf flunking.
Yeah. You wouldn't think the Costa Rican Civil War was a subject that would lend itself to levity.
But it does.
But you'd be wrong. Yeah.
You'd be wrong.
So the Costa Rican Civil War, the career of Don Pepe, Tom now knows all about Don Pepe. Don't you, Tom? We've done the Rif War in Morocco in the 1920s.
That's a pretty good
What
story.
Else have we done?
That was a very Somerton Man. Story. The Somerton Man.
Australia. That was
Australia's
brilliant.
Greatest murder mystery with a stunning breakthrough this summer. Dido, Queen of Carthage for Tunisia.
Yeah, that was a good one. The History of Qatar.
The History of Qatar, yes.
Yeah.
So anyway, lots of fun stuff to come.
We've got I've got a pile of papers. Amy Mantravadi is asking, how do you find the time? I've got a pile of notes on the Uruguayan urban guerrillas of the 1970s.
We're doing the hard ones, aren't we? Oh, the Ashanti.
You've done the Ashanti. That was good. Yeah. That was very good. That was jolly good.
A bit nervous about the amount of sacrifice in it.
Are you?
Well,
I've done that one already.
I feel I'm not on top of the anthropology of it, but
time will tell. If you're worried about that kind of thing, we'd never have started this podcast in the first place.
No, you're right. You're right.
So we're sort of, we're motoring through these. Who knows how we'll release them? We obviously will release them at some point, probably before the tournament starts.
It's going to be 32.
They have nothing to do with
football. That's a month.
Yeah. Wales. Paul Williams asks about Wales. I lined up a Welsh guest, a top Welsh historian. An absolutely tip-top Welsh historian will be coming on the program because we agreed
Anglo-Welsh relations.
That it would be wrong for Tom and I to do Anglo-Welsh relations ourselves, even though I am actually a quarter Welsh. I'm a quarter Welsh, but we've got a proper Welshman who's done a lot of. He's written books about Anglo-Welsh relations. I won't tell you who he is in case he pulls out. But anyway, it's not Neil Kinnock, Brogan Savage.
Oh, Tony. Tony's kicking in. I can confirm we'll spread out the content over more than 16 days. That's good to know.
That's good news because it's less work for us in the long run. So.
Yeah, it is. And I've walked off as Dyke, so I feel very well qualified.
Talk about
Anglo-Welsh relations. We've got Alianz coming.
To talk every year.
Where do you
go? Sorry. We went to a place called Trasaith in Cardigan Bay.
Lovely.
It was basically full of people from Birmingham. On holiday.
Well, you must have felt at home then.
Yeah. Sorry, yes.
We've got Ali Ansari doing Anglo-Iranian relations, and we're going to do Anglo-American relations. So those are the three that England are playing, Wales, Iran, and the United States.
We'll play more matches than that, Tom.
Well, time will tell, won't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, so lots to look forward to. Should we get on to China?
We should. Just quick answer to Alice Scarlett. When will Lady Jane Grey be out? So Lady Jane Grey...
2 weeks' time.
Pretty soon, I would have thought. Isn't it? Yeah.
2 weeks' time.
And Lady Jane Grey. So, I actually genuinely can't wait to listen back to that because I thought that was... I loved doing
that. That was fun, wasn't it? That was another really one. We said, I wonder if we'll manage... It'll stretch to 40 minutes.
Yeah.
2 hours later.
3 hours later. Yeah, exactly. But that's because we did it in immensely forensic detail.
We did.
Didn't we? We did it in far more forensic detail than anybody would expect. Two people.
So Lady Jane Grey is 10th of October.
Judas.
So it's Marilyn Monroe is Monday. Jane Austen and the Invention of Trousers is Thursday. And Lady Jane Grey is following week. Two episodes.
Ian Bould says, when's Neil Price and the Vikings? We've got him stacked up somewhere, haven't we?
We're saving it. Might be a New Year treat.
Surely we'll come out before then, won't it?
We've got to do King Alfred, haven't we?
We're doing two on King Alfred to publicise. Just before we get onto China, there's an excellent new book coming out in Christmas, probably the definitive book on the Vikings and the birth of modern England. It's called Fury of the Vikings. Now, it may look as if it's aimed at people aged about 9, but I really do encourage you all to go online. You can order it now on Amazon. Fury of the Vikings. You'll thank me for it.
If you would like a book more explicitly aimed at an adult reader, there are other titles available. Books, for instance, on Athelstan.
Top work. That is top. Sometimes I give the producers a hard time, but that is absolutely tip-top work.
Sometimes I lie awake in the middle of the night wondering why Dominic's books get promoted and my biography of Athelstan doesn't.
Right. Okay, let's talk about China.
Rana.
So, lots of lovely comments about Rana, for which, I mean, I'm not actually that grateful because they're not about me. But if I were Rana, I'd be very grateful. He is a brilliant guest. He does have that unique thing, doesn't he, Tom?
He can talk.
He just talks.
In perfect prose.
Yeah.
Absolutely sculpted prose.
Yeah. And he also has a brilliant recall of his own book, which often people don't have. Because often we'll have read their books. And they'll come on and they'll tell a story. And I kind of think to myself, I'll say to Tom afterwards,
I'm not sure that's quite right.
I think you'd have told his own story better than he would, But Rana, absolutely fantastic. And I think those episodes are two of the most eye-opening episodes we've done. Because... they're such a challenge to the kind of Western-centric view of the Second World War, aren't they?
The
I mean, not least I mean, the when the war even started.
Yeah, but the scale of it. I mean, the dam.
Yeah. Yeah, the killing of all those people.
I've never even heard of that.
Blowing up the dams, yeah.
Until I read his book. I've never heard.
Yeah, the dams, the battle for Shanghai, what happens in...
Nanjing massacre.
Nanjing. All of that sort of stuff. Battles that you've barely even heard of. Well, you haven't heard of. And sieges and occupations and so on.
Famines in which millions of people die. I just...
Yeah.
But the same kind of... whoa... that we had with the Cultural Revolution, which I knew more about, actually. But even that, you know, he was brilliant on that, wasn't he? Kind of
and I think actually those episodes,
madness and terror of it.
Some of the episodes I've done that have made me think differently than if I'd never done the podcast at all. So they make sense of China in a way that's, you know, previously I just hadn't really understood China. It just took this history was a sort of baffling blur, but also the sheer, you know, the huge authoritarianism, the emphasis on stability, all of those kinds of things, the sort of risk aversion of the Chinese leadership. Yeah, they make also, so much more sense, yeah, don't they? When you think about what happened in
how
in
many
China's
people country. Died, how many people died, how much destruction there was, it does make complete sense. And we've got lots more coming up on China. So we've got Julia Lovell, who is the other great British historian.
Yeah,
of China.
Somebody's just asked, are you going to have Julia Lovell?
We do. So she is coming on. There's an exhibition at the British Museum in the spring, I think, that she has curated. So she will come on and, I think, talk about the 18th century, 19th century.
So the Opium Wars, we've got a couple of people, Lauren Dillon, Spiffer. They're asking about the Opium Wars. They'd be a brilliant subject, I think, wouldn't they?
I hope that we can get her to talk about the Opium Wars as well. She didn't want to talk specifically about the Opium Wars, but they will be part of the story. They will be an aspect of it. And also, she is going to come on and we're going to ask her about aspects of China that seem to be something that we would take for granted, say rice, or the unity of the kingdom, or the Great Wall. She wrote a brilliant book on the Great Wall of China. How far back can we trace these? So in other words, or silk. So when does something recognizable as China come into being? Where are the various elements coming from? So I think that'll be great as well. So we're very fortunate, I think, to have two such brilliant historians of China.
We are. 99 High King says, are you going to do anything about medieval China? I don't know anything at all about medieval China.
Yeah,
I'll tell you what I do know about. I've got I'm doing that podcast in the World Cup about the history of South Korea, and I'm now
top Korean courtesan,
well informed about Korean courtesans. So that was fun to research online. We should do a lot more China actually, because it's actually the nearest thing I've come to in this podcast to because, you know, when you do a lot of history, it's hard to kind of get that shock of the new, the thrill of the new that you have when you're young and you're encountering things completely for the first time. But with some of this stuff, I mean, it's just mind-blowing, isn't it?
I read just last week, and I recommend this, a book by a man called William Han, who is from Taiwan, went to New Zealand. So he's a New Zealander, lived in America, then chucked it in. And he went off to China to follow in the footsteps of a Chinese ambassador in the 2nd century AD, so the time of Trajan, who went from China to try and discover the Roman Empire, to discover the truth of these rumors of a great empire in the West. And he went all the way along the Silk Road, so through what is now the Stans, through Afghanistan, into Iran. And he reached the Persian Gulf. So he was, he was a few days' journey from the Roman Empire. And he reached the Persian Gulf, saw the sea for the first time, and got told, no, the Roman Empire, doesn't exist. It's miles away. So he went all the way back.
Oh, my gosh.
It's called, I think, From the Wall to the Sea. Yeah, From the Wall to the Water.
The Wall to the Water.
And he messaged me on Twitter and said, would you like to read this book? And I kind of thought, oh, not really, because quite a lot of people messaged me and asked if I want to read books. But because I'd just been writing about Trajan, and I was interested. I think that's why he messaged me. I'd put something up about it on Twitter. And I thought, actually, yeah, I would quite like to read that. It's really good. I think it's his first book. So if you have any interest in history of China, the Silk Road, all that kind of stuff, it's very, very good. It's very funny. It's very, and he's a very, very entertaining character. Lots of sharp opinions.
Sounds good. Sounds good.
So I commend that.
We've got a load of great suggestions here. So the Russo-Japanese War from Jake. I agree, that's a fascinating subject. And topical. That's obviously very topical. Matthew Hawkes. Matthew, you're not the first person by any means to say when you're going to do an episode about the Troubles. I think we'd end up doing more than one. The truth is we will do it, but we just need to have a tiny bit more time, I think, in our schedules so we can do it properly. And really sort of, I need to refresh my memory of a couple of things because I've written about the Troubles quite a lot in my post-war Britain books. It's the kind of thing you wouldn't want to make a mistake.
Get it wrong, would you?
Yeah, disastrous consequences. Fiona, she says about Cambodia, I actually think the Khmer Rouge would be a brilliant topic. It's something I do know a bit about, but I don't know anything about Cambodia before 1970. You probably know about Angkor Wat. Do you tell me you love all
I
that
don't,
stuff?
I don't know very much about Angkor Wat, but I quite like to go and see it. So perhaps do it after.
On location. Mm. Richard Hindley asks about the Korean War. We did talk about doing the Korean War for the World Cup, and we decided it was too big a topic. But we will, I'm sure, do the Korean War at some point. FDR, yes, FDR would come. The Boxer Rebellion, they're just all coming now, Tom. They've got a bit carried away. The Bodleian.
Well,
the London Library.
That's a very good question. So the Bodleian, of course, is shorthand for going on the internet.
What?
I have been to the London Library. Well, no.
I've never heard
Not always. Not. The London Library is a private lending library that was set up by Thackeray, I think, wasn't it? It's excellent. I'm a member. I have been going there.
I have only ever been to the London Library once. So David Kynaston, who writes post-war, also writes post-war Britain books, and I suppose people think of him as my rival. He took me on a tour of the London Library last year, Tom. Very nice. It's a very nice library. Yeah, I mean, okay, so, we believe you. We believe that you went there.
Look, Carthage of History, I got that for Dido.
Oh, well done. I think the Bodleian is better, but you can't take the books out. I think the Bodleian is an amazing place to work. I used to do my... when I was an undergraduate, I used to go and work. All the history books were in the Radcliffe Camera in Radcliffe Square in Oxford. And that is an incredible place to go and, you know, write your essay or whatever.
We had some publicity shots there, didn't we? What happened to Historical Jesus? Yes. Okay, so we have big plans for Christmas. So Historical Jesus will be a Christmas special. And I went to see my friend James Carlton Paget, who is a leading figure in the study of early Christianity. I took him out for a drink and we talked for hours about it. So I feel quite on top of it. So that will be coming. We also have History of Booze, don't we? We're going to go to a festive pub and talk about drink.
We're
going to do vampires, and we've got Fergus Butler Galley talking about eccentric vicars. So
yeah,
lots of Christmas fare.
So there'll be some of our Christmas ones. A couple more things I've picked up. Charles Joynson is absolutely quite right. The Wolves in the 1950s, when we invented European football and were the best team in the world. That would be an excellent topic, but I think that's probably for our 1,000th episode.
I think that's snooker, isn't it?
Unbelievable.
Tony Bang won the only poll ever done and completely ignored. That's not fair, as I have said.
Tom, if you were as keen an Aston Villa fan as you claim, you would have taken the opportunity to insist that you would do one on the 1982 European Cup.
Yeah, it's the only... it's up there. 81, 82 were the golden years for...
They were.
My sporting enthusiasms.
So Josh Wilcox asks about JFK. What happened with JFK is this. JFK kind of got lost... didn't it, Tom?
Ukraine. We were going to do it, and then Ukraine happened.
I think it was something like that. Yeah. So JFK kind of got lost. Then we realized that next year is obviously the anniversary. So 1963, 2023. And we thought it would be mad not to do it November 2023, do an episode about Kennedy and then at least one episode about the assassination and the conspiracy theories and what it means.
However, if you do want to hear us talking about the Kennedy about Kennedy and assassination and conspiracy theories, we do obviously touch on that in our Maryland episode.
Yeah, we do a bit. We do. So I've sort of lost track of the the JFK episode. Got shot down, says Lee Kuan Yew, respecter. Yeah, but who shot it down? I mean, was it the producers or was it?
It's Vladimir Putin.
Christmas special and the history of Christmas specials. I hope we'll still have the rest of his history at the end of 2023, says Laureano. I don't think there's any doubt about that, is there, Tom? Stephen Clark. Yeah, we've thought about that and we decided no. So what can I say? We just
didn't have room.
Yeah,
we didn't have space, didn't have room. Did we? Too busy talking about trousers and stuff, French films.
Yeah. It's just a hard balance, isn't it? Because you don't want... I know that not everybody loves the modern stuff. A lot of people like the Romans or the medieval. Some people like the sort of the more amorphous episodes where we're talking about themes. Some people like the sort of blow-by-blow narratives. So it's just we're always sort of struggling with getting the right balance, aren't we, Tom?
It's a box of Quality Street, isn't it, Dominic?
Yeah, Midland Redux asked an excellent question. Could you do Eisenhower instead? I suppose the trouble with Eisenhower at Midland is Eisenhower might be perceived by some people as a bit boring. Now, well, I didn't really think Eisenhower was boring, but I think some people might.
He was the first...
Oswald did it, and he was right to do it. Yeah,
the first good. American president to go to a test match.
Eisenhower?
Yeah, in Pakistan.
Henry Kissinger... when he was Secretary of State in the mid-70s, was taken by Anthony Crosland to watch Grimsby Town.
Was he?
What? Yeah,
was he?
So and he was Foreign Secretary, was MP for Grimsby.
Okay, so lower league football trivia. The only English team to play in Scottish League.
Berwick Rangers?
Yeah, very good.
Something that was obvious because you'd been to Berwick.
Well, I just throw that out because that brings us, because you know, in the end is my beginning. I think that's a perfect way.
So that was actually beautiful.
We began with Berwick and now we've ended it. Yeah. So there you go. So I think it is time for me to go and have my supper.
Okay. You've left it very late. Yeah, you should eat earlier. Try to eat earlier.
Yeah, I know. So
if you were American, you would eat earlier. Americans eat very early.
Yeah, but I'm Spanish.
Yeah.
It's my, you know, continental ways.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did, Charles Joydenson. Very good. Very good spot. Sorry, Tom, I'm just really overexcited
Kissinger going to see Wolves is... I mean, it's kind of...
Actually, Kissinger, you know, Henry Kissinger would be a superb subject for this podcast because Kissinger is a fascinating historical figure his background in Germany, but also because he's such a student of history and so, you know, he basically thinks he's Metternich.
And his gallantry with Princess Diana.
Was he very gallant with Princess Diana? What did he do with Princess Diana?
There's a famous photo of her being gallant.
Really? Oh, God. I'll Google
rush
it
off and have a look.
Change all the pictures of South Koreans. right.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks ever so much, everyone. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you enjoy the episodes that are coming up.
It was more wittering as usual, I'm afraid, today. I keep thinking that normal service of more sort of substantive, serious chat will be resumed, but it never is. But who knows? Maybe next time. Right. Thank you so much for all your support. We really appreciate it. We're very much looking forward to seeing some of you who are Athelstans at the Athelstan get-together in November, aren't we, Tom?
We are.
Some of you, of course, at the live events in Clapham the next day. And, till then, look after yourselves, and we will see you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.